Hello and welcome to the Worn and Wound podcast. My name is Blake Bettner, and today I'm joined by Zach Weiss. Hello, Zach.
Hello.
I'm joined by Blake Mallon. Hello, Blake.
Hello.
And I'm joined by James Helms. James, how you doing?
Hi, everybody.
So let's start off. First off, this is going to be a Q&A episode. We're really excited to answer some of the questions that we received from you. Thank you to everyone who sent them in. Before we get to that there, let's do a little bit of a wrist check. I guess we can just skip over James, right? Since we already know he's, I'm assuming.
I guess that's true. I was gonna try and just throw something else on, but I guess you're right. I'll just
say that. You can catch him cheating. Yeah. So he's still wearing his Yema. Zach Weiss, what are you wearing?
I have on a prototype of the Christopher Ward Worn and Wound C65 Sandstorm that we launched earlier this week. Very excited to have unveiled this, excited to be wearing it now and like telling people I'm wearing it now. I guess I had it for a little while before that, but yeah, very exciting. It was a great launch, and we hope everyone who got one and gets it soon is very excited about it. Please share when you do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a super cool watch. Blake Mallon, what are you wearing?
I am wearing Sin 103 with the acrylic crystal. I think it's the ST or the SA. I always forget specifically. Been around for a long time. I don't wear it quite as much as I probably should, but you know, Sin recently released a sort of all green model of this one. That is really beautiful.
Very cool.
And it got me thinking about this watch. And every time I put it on, I'm like, I really should wear this more. And frankly, like of all the watches in my collection, I have like strangely gotten comments from total strangers about this watch, which is kind of interesting because it's just like a, you know, a black dial chronograph. But yeah, so that's what I'm wearing.
It's a striking watch though, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me that you get comments on it. It's a great looking watch, and Sin has been killing it lately.
Yeah.
But it's easy to forget, like, they've got a great back catalog too.
Totally, yeah. And it's like when people comment on it, they don't know what it is. It's never someone like, oh, that's a nice Rolex reference, whatever. It's like, nope, that's just a handsome watch that I've never seen before. So.
Yeah, right on. I am wearing a Baltic Aquascaf GMT. This is a watch that Baltic released today, I believe.
Yeah, I think they officially announced it today, the day we're recording.
The day that we are recording this. Yeah. Big shout out to Baltic on the release there. I think there's a few different colorways. They're all very fun, very wearable watches. So keep an eye out for our thoughts on this watch coming to the site very soon.
Yeah, and our interview with Etienne
about
it as part of the Wind Up Watch Fair. I think the day they actually officially go on sale, we'll have the watches or somewhere around there. We get sort of go deeper into the development of the watch, which is cool.
Yeah. So we record this and we'll be publishing this about right in the middle of the Wind Up Watch Fair. Blake, tell us how it's going.
It's going great. The feedback has been really great so far from like readers and the brands. I think people are having a lot of fun sort of seeing such like a constant stream of content, specifically the video content. It's been a little while since we've been able to post videos and things on Worn and Wound, and so it's just been great to kind of talk to people about all their various, you know, projects. We've got some really cool stuff coming up. There's still, like I said, we've got interviews with Laurier, Baltic, a whole slew of others, Oak and Oscar, Zodiac. There's just tons more content coming throughout the next week. We also have our giveaway running still. So it's a big group giveaway. We've got prizes from Laurier and Christopher Ward and Stoa and a whole slew of other people. That's going to be open all throughout the fair. So just go to windupwatchfair.com.
It's like 20 prizes.
Yeah. We're going to pick 20 winners. So it's not just one winner. It's like a whole bunch of stuff. We'll pick a winner. They'll get to pick from the full slate of prizes. We'll pick another winner. They'll pick from what's remaining and so on. So this is the biggest giveaway we've ever done. And so it's going really well, and there's a lot of really cool stuff there. And then we also, in the Wind Up Watch Shop, we have Double Points. So for those who aren't familiar, over at the Wind Up Watch Shop, we have a loyalty program where you get, you know, 5 points typically for every dollar you spend in the shop. Right now, all throughout Wind Up, you get 10 points for every dollar you spend. So, if there's something in the shop you've been checking out, that's definitely a good time to pick something up.
Yeah, right on. Load up for the holidays.
Yeah.
Well, that's great to hear. I know it was a lot of fun putting a lot of this content together. So hopefully it's going over well out there. All right, let's jump into some of the questions that we received. We are going to start out with a question from @JKWeistShots. Weist shots.
It's always hard to pronounce them. You don't have to spell them.
Yes. My apologies in advance if I butcher a lot of these handles. So his question or her question is, what's the most versatile watch you've seen this year? I'm going to kick it over to Zach Weiss to start this one out.
Okay. Well, there's been actually a pretty good year of releases, and there's just so much that has come out. It's almost hard to remember everything, particularly from like before, like the first half of the year, I'd say. But I mean, a few come to mind, but I'm going to name the one that's probably for anyone who has been listening to the podcast, following me on Instagram, probably could guess. And that is the Seiko SPB 149, or just the whole 14X series. So that is their modern recreation of the 62 Moss. It was kind of a surprising release initially. It's 40.5 millimeters. It's really just beautifully sized, beautifully proportioned. To watch that after reviewing, I couldn't let go of and end up picking up one for myself, really because of its versatility. It's sort of like, was that dive watch I kind of knew I was looking for and didn't know what it would be. And I think there's some higher price options out there, but I didn't want to go for them because I just wasn't looking to spend that much. And then this came in at that like $1,200 price point, less than some of the other colorways, and it just was exactly what I wanted. So that's my choice.
Yeah, excellent. You can't go wrong there. Yeah. So when I hear versatility, I think a watch that you could like slum around the yard in drinking beers, mm-hmm. and also like dress it up to the nines, yeah. and if you needed to. What do you think?
Well, no, and I totally agree. I think versatility is like an important thing to look for in watches, particularly watches that you want to like wear often that aren't like niche, you know. Yeah. It's like versus like a dress watch, which is like to me the opposite of versatility, almost like a very formal watch. And just to reiterate why, you know, maybe the Seiko was good for that. The size just makes it wear comfortable, but then it's got their super hard coating on it. And that includes on the bracelet if you wish to wear it on the bracelet. So yeah, when you're slumming around the yard, as you say, if you want to do some yard work or something, like no fear there. But then it's got that kind of elegant, you know, stylish vintage dive watch nature to it too. So throw it on some leather, throw it on the bracelet, wear it with, you know, work attire, et cetera. And it does not look out of place at all, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, absolutely. Blake Mallon, what do you think?
Sure. So I've been thinking about this a little bit, and I'm going to pick something that kind of relates to my personal life right now as we speak. So we were actually just talking about this before we sat down to record the podcast, but I am currently personally debating the purchase of a Black Bay 58, and I am debating whether or not I would want to get the black version or the blue version. Mm-hmm. So my choice is going to be the blue version of the Black Bay 58 as a very, very versatile watch. And I think that's kind of the case that it's making to me as to why it would be the choice between the two watches, is that I think you can wear it on the bracelet and it can be like a super sporty kind of tool watch. You could put it on a NATO and it's going to feel much more rugged. I don't know if you could dress it up quite so much, but I think it would look good on a cordovan strap or like a textured sort of the sort of pebbled leather strap. There's like a lot of different looks it could go really well with. So that one kind of comes to mind. But so sort of in my internal debate is I think I'm personally drawn to the style of the Black Bay 58, but the blue one I feel like is the smart choice and the versatile choice.
Yeah, I put that on one of our taupe Wyckoff straps, I believe, which is that pebbled effect. And it's like a very much like a more dressy strap, just to see what it looked like when we had that watch in for review. And it worked. It totally worked, you know. And I feel like, you know, obviously because that has that vintage sub aesthetic to it, like, you know, these days it might not have been ever originally created for it, but these days like rocking a vintage sub with a suit is a look, mm-hmm. you know, obviously. So like this is the modern, you know, way to do that sort of.
Yeah, for sure.
So permission to go on a tangent, Blake, I thought you were about to pull the trigger on an Explorer.
Yeah. So I was looking at a 14270 Explorer. I'm sort of in the midst of flipping things. And that was sort of a watch I was thinking about getting. I still really love that watch. Still very much maybe one day would consider adding it to my collection. But a very nice friend of ours had one and let me borrow it for, you know, a few days and wear it around. And I just didn't like immediately connect to it. Mm. And I think it's also a little, I don't want to call it plain because that sounds like it's degrading it, but it's like my tastes have, I think, gone into a slightly more, like into the direction of wanting things that are just like slightly more interesting or colorful or whatever the case may be. And that's kind of why I'm personally drawn to the Black Bay 58 Black, because it's got the red pip at 12 o'clock or the triangle at 12 o'clock. It's got the gilt. It's kind of got a little bit more going on. Plus, generally speaking, the watch has, you know, like the riveted bracelet and things like that. So yes, Explorer was on the table. Get out of here, Explorer.
I agree with you because I think the 58, but I'm more team blue. I think that the Black Bay 58 is a much, I wouldn't say much more, but more versatile than the Explorer.
Yeah. And I think also like I like the 36 millimeter size of that watch, of the 14270, but I think the size of the Black Bay 58 fits my wrist a little bit better.
So I think this is worth talking about just a little bit more because it's the same thing in the SPB model that you mentioned, which has one of them comes with a blue dial and black bezel, but there is also a version that has like a gilt or at least kind of the aged loom as well.
There are four versions. So the SBB 149 is the one I picked up, and that's got the like blue-gray dial. There's the 143, which has
a
gray-gray dial, and that's like the one James Stacy reviewed on Hodinkee. And then there's in between, so I guess the 145 and the 147, and those ones have like, I think the 145 is almost like a brown with sort of ochre-y, like, you know,
it's supposed to look like.
They have more of that kind of style to it. Yeah. I haven't seen one of those in the metal, and it's a kind of a different look for Seiko. I don't know.
Yeah, I
can say if it's successful or not.
Well, yeah. I mean, James, you brought up that you're on Team Blue, and I was just mentioning to Blake as well that I think the blue is the right selection here as well. And my reasoning was that. I think that it will age better in time, that in maybe 5, 10, 15 years, that watches that have the kind of artificial aging applied to them will look very much of this era that we're in right now. And I could see people looking back and saying, it looked really cool when I got it, but, you know, if I had just gotten the one without that, or if I'd gotten a watch that didn't have the artificial aging, it would already be doing its own thing maybe by now. Not that it's going to age to like a brown or anything, but at least it's, you know, something that you could have aged yourself, whatever that means to you. Like it's always going to have that kind of artificiality to it. I know the Black Bay 58 is maybe not, I know it's like a gilt dial, right? It's not like it leans too heavily into that realm, but my feeling is that the blue one would be like the more timeless choice.
Yeah.
Here.
I think someone could make the claim that the sort of Black Bay 58 is sort of in costume of a vintage watch, whereas the blue is a modern interpretation of a lineage of Submariners.
If they made that watch today, like this is what it would look like, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Similar to like with the Pelagos, I think. Yeah. You know, like the Black Bay, the Black Bay was always like you're playing up the vintage elements. The Pelagos is like, what does it look like if they made it in whenever that came out, 2012, 2015, you know, sometime around there.
Fingers crossed for the 40 or 39 millimeter Pelagos someday.
I mean, if that's the watch. Yeah. That's actually one of the watches I just sold, honestly, if you had asked me a year ago if I would ever sell that watch, I probably would have said no way. But I mean, if they ever come out with a smaller Pelagos, like I'm selling whatever I need to sell and buying that immediately.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I feel that way too. Like that could be immediate, like.
That's a like buy it right away.
Trade a Speedy for it. Maybe not. I'll take that back. But you know, something along those lines.
All right, James Helms, what about you? What's the most versatile watch that you've seen this year?
So versatile for me is like a 007 or, once again, people probably won't agree with me on this, but a Submariner. I think those are very versatile watches because you can wear them with pretty much anything. You don't really have to match it with anything. You don't have to take it off. So I really think that just the recent release of the new steel or bicolor Zodiac GMTs, I think they've really kind of hit the nail on the head with versatility on those watches, because it's a great watch. It's a dive watch, but it's GMT. So I guess you can kind of go either way. But the recent kind of generation of Zodiac has been very colorful, which I love, and I think people in general love, because it just brings life into that whole product line. But with their newest GMT, which they kind of call their core, that really to me is going to be timeless, because it's going to go for 10, 20, 30, 40 years and still be a great looking watch no matter what. you can change the bracelet out, put a nylon, put a leather on it, and it looks just as good. And you can use it pretty much anywhere. And because the bezel doesn't, I mean, it has typography on it, but it doesn't really have anything else. You know, you can scratch it up and it won't look bad. So I think that's a really good watch that, you know, there's been a lot of interesting watches this year. But that one, which really just came out this week, has been the most versatile, I would say, this year.
All right. Yeah. I think that's a good answer.
Yeah.
I think that steel look a lot.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good call too, because like you're saying, it stands out in their collection in that it's rather plain. But also, I was just pulling up the image. One of the things I really like about that steel model is it still has like the GMT hand is like this sort of reddish purpley color. It's like it's not sort of a typical GMT hand color. It's unique looking. Mm-hmm. It stands out as being a little bit different. So you feel like you still get that kind of Zodiac flavor in there.
Yeah. Still a little spice thrown in there, right?
Yeah.
And one thing that I like about the GMT, Super Sue of GMT cases that you might not realize until you're like holding it side by side with a normal Super Sue off, but there's an extra bevel on the lugs. So like if you look at a top-down shot, you'll notice the lugs on the normal Super Seawolf are flat, essentially. On the GMT, they kind of cut in. And on the wrist, that makes it wear much more kind of streamlined and slender. And it has a very like nice overall effect and kind of gives it, frankly, a little bit of a more of an upscale sort of, you know, fit and finish.
Hmm. I didn't even notice that until just now.
Yeah, it's like... It's something you don't notice like until you, and we just, because I happen to have had, you know, both and at the same time in the office kind of picked up on it. So
yeah, I like details like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think both of the 58 and the SPB are excellent choices, and they would kind of fall more in my wheelhouse in terms of watches that I would wear every day. But just to be a little different, in terms of like a true versatile watch, I was thinking the Monta Noble is a pretty versatile watch. It's, I know it reads at a glance like pretty dressy and formal, but having seen one in the flesh and tried it on some different straps, I think that's a watch that you could easily bang around in something, you know, like fishing or yard work or whatever, but also would look right at home in like a full-on black tie attire, I think, right, and pretty much everything in between. So that would be my selection. Nice job, Monta, on that one. I think
I'm glad you mixed it up and went with something without like a bezel that's essentially a dive watch. It's kind of interesting we all went there, like what in our minds, you know, I guess by virtue of being a like diver or dive base, it suggests like that extra level of utility or ruggedness that probably will never use, but it's like that's part of that versatility.
Yeah.
But in terms of like day-to-day wear, like a simple three hand is probably the most, really.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think it also speaks to our styles. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I think, I mean, maybe this is an oddball pick, but something like a Ming watch could be kind of interesting. I always found his watches to be in some ways kind of dressy, but then because they have this very unique kind of funky aesthetic to them that they could feel very casual at the same time. And obviously some of his watches are pretty complicated or high end, as we've discussed. So, you know, I guess depending on your sort of your look, your style, it kind of, your mind could go different places.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on, to the next question. This one is from at CMRCS21. Again, I apologize if that is...
No, I think that was perfect. I think that's exactly how you
that's
say it.
That's what he's going for. Okay. So he or she is asking thoughts on watch winders and storage options. So what do you guys use watch winders? Do you have watch boxes? I know they're in the wind-up shop.
The three of us are maybe a little biased.
Yeah. I think our opinion on this is going to be a little shaded because we sell them and we manufacture them. But
yeah,
I guess
and
like,
long-winded too.
Yeah.
We've got a lot.
So I'll be totally straight. I'll be very honest, sort of taking off the sort of shop hat. So I have several of our watch boxes just sort of by my desk at work where I keep watches. And then I also have a winder that we sell there. I'll be honest, personally, with the winder, I could kind of take it or leave it, personally. Like, I the one we sell and the one we have is it's pretty silent. It's totally unobtrusive. I find it to be attractive. So from that perspective, like I have no, like I don't think there's a problem with getting them. I think they could fit into your, you know, your look, your home aesthetic kind of a thing. You know, one of the things I find is that, you know, only one watch can go in there. So I've got a whole slew of watches that I kind of want wound all the time, but I always have to pick what goes in there. It's not really how I wear my watches that I have one watch I always want wound up. So it's kind of like random what's wound up. I find that it sometimes will influence the watches that I'm wearing because, mm-hmm. Oh, that one's running. Like, I'm just going to grab that, which I don't love. And also, I kind of enjoy the ritual of winding my watch and sort of playing with it when I pick it out of the box. So... and obviously if it's a hand wound or a quartz watch, it's not relevant to you. But, unless you're going to like ball out and get a million winders or one of those like huge winder arrays, I think most people could probably go without a winder or like people like me, but, mm-hmm.
But if you have two watches,
yeah, exactly. You know, yeah.
Or your collection of perpetual calendars.
Yeah. I mean, totally. Yeah. Then it's a must, you know, generally speaking. But I will say, if I can just keep going on the subject of winders real quick on boxes, I just to plug the watch box that we do make, I have to say, like, I've always sort of cringed looking at the watch boxes that I purchased in the past. Cause I've always bought the really cheap, ugly ones just out of pure utility. And so it's been very nice to have something nice looking on the shelf. Like, I feel like I go to it and I'm like, oh, this is nice looking. And then I open it up and I'm like, these are nice looking things. So,
yeah.
So I like that.
Yeah. I think that's reasonable. So I'll jump in here because I have, no visibility into what's going on in the shop by design. I do not use a watch winder and I don't really have a desire to because I enjoy the interaction with my watches. This is also why I don't really care about the power reserves. I know that's maybe like a hot take, but I like hand wound watches. I like, if I'm going to wear a watch, I like to wind it and set it. And then I feel like, okay, I'm good to go with this thing for a day or two or whatever. And then I'll move on to a different watch. But to me, that's kind of like, it's kind of an intimate thing that you get with your collection. And again, I don't have annual calendars. I don't have perpetual calendars. So all the watches I have are relatively straightforward in winding and setting them. And this, you know, none of this to mention like the space constraints, like you say, right? Like a lot of these aren't very small things. I don't know where I'd put them. I have a roll that I stick my watches in. But I will say the toolbox watch case that you guys make is fantastic. I like it a lot. It looks great. It feels great. It feels like kind of a like a heavy duty toolbox, which I guess was the idea, right? So, mm-hmm. So I like that, and I keep a lot of the just kind of kick around watches that I have in that thing, and then the watches that are kind of more a part of my daily rotation, I guess, weekly rotation, monthly rotation. Mm-hmm. I keep in the roll. You know, that would be traveling with me, I guess, right? And so that's my take on it. I know that other people feel differently about this kind of stuff, and a winder is a fun product to have. So where do you guys fall on this, James or Zach?
So I'll keep mine short. When I travel, I use a small pouch, depending on the expensiveness of the watch. So if it's relatively inexpensive or versatile, I'll just throw it in a pouch. If it's more expensive, I have like a small Pelican case, which I throw in my bag so it doesn't get knocked around. At the house, I always use the toolbox. Prior to that, my mother bought me like 15, 20 years ago, a red envelope from Robert Redford, mainly because she loves Robert Redford, but it was a glass topped leather bound box. And I always found those really helpful because you can see in there and you can just grab whatever you want. So now the toolbox is just a little bit bigger for me. Winders, I kind of fall in the same category. If I had two watches, I would use a winder all the time. But nature of the beast here is that we don't, and none of us here have two watches. So that's a little bit of an issue. And you've constantly got a watch that's not dead, but not wound. So it's just kind of the nature of what you're getting used to. But if I had far less watches, which someday I hope to have far less watches, but, I would use a winder quite a bit, but I've never actually used one. So it'll be a good day when I'm able to use a winder.
So for me, you know, funny, I actually do not have a functioning winder right now. I've had them in the past from other brands, and the ones we had the one that it broke, you know, it just, or eventually, like, this one from many years ago, I just don't want to name the brand. It just eventually got wind, like the motors started going, and then eventually annoyed me, and I just unplugged it, and that was kind of that. I should get one of our winders, you know, because I do have a watch that I want to be wound, which is the Speedmaster Triple Calendar. And while that's not like an annual calendar, perpetual calendar kind of thing, where like it dying would mess everything up, because date mechanisms are more finicky, every time I have to set it again, I feel like this might be the time something breaks, and then that will be just unfortunate. So I'd kind of rather just keep it going and only have to adjust it, you know, for, you know, different length months, et cetera. So that would be the watch I would keep in there, and then rather than rotating. But then in terms of the storage, I have like the toolbox at home that I keep sort of like my deep storage, like the watches that I wear less frequently. And then the watches I wear most frequently are in Rolls. Mm. And I often have it with me. I often move it around. It's like, I don't know, I like to have my watches near me, I guess. And like I switch them a lot. So yeah I always have a few watch Rolls in rotation for just for like keeping my like most active watches in, you know?
Yeah. I think it's also worth sort of shouting out some other like nice carrying cases and winders and stuff that are out there. So I saw Analog Shift recently released like a nice, they call it like the Cork Collection, and they've made several nice boxes, but it's like it's all cork material and it's really neat looking. Like it's very cool.
Yeah.
So like I thought that was really nice. I don't know the price, unfortunately, but I'm sure if you just go to Analog Shift's website, you could find it. A product we don't make or sell, rather, but I've always really loved are the tubes, like the leather watch tubes. Mm-hmm. They're much better for watches with bracelets. I find them really beautiful. Hodinkee sells them. Everest Bands has some nice ones. They're all over the place, and I think there's a lot of really good options.
Right, and the idea there is for watches that don't just neatly fold flat.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of like integrated bracelets. Sometimes you get leather straps too that like they don't want to fully fold under a watch. And, you know, if you push too much pressure, you can kind of mar it against the case. Yeah.
I can see being that being like a nice option for travel. But then also in terms of winders, definitely worth checking out the guys over at Juvo. Mm-hmm. Their whole thing is sort of higher end winder components at a relatively more affordable price. So if you are the kind of person who wants to go check out like a 3 or 4 watch tower or winder tower kind of a thing, like they have you covered. So there are a lot of cool options out there. I think especially in the box category, I feel like things have gotten better.
Yeah. And for real, sky's the limit here. I mean, you can get 6-figure safes with built-in winders to put on your yacht or wherever you do your thing. So all right, I hope that answers your question, CM Marcius 21. Thank you for sending that in. Now we're going to move on to a question from Tartan Watch Spaniel, at Tartan Watch Spaniel. When you buy a watch from a different country, does it make you want to visit that country? James Helms.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so.
All right.
I think before I even was in the watch industry, you know, visiting Switzerland was definitely top of my list because of just the different approach to engineering that they have and the very old style, you know, where they came from with watch engineering. So, you know, when I finally got a chance to go there, I was blown away at how different they approach really small scale manufacturing to how we do here in the US. And then, you know, we had a chance to visit Germany as well. And they have a totally different approach. While it's very similar, you know, I think when we visited to Moscow, there was some very different feel to their manufacturing versus Switzerland. You know, so I won't go deep into what those differences are, but you can definitely tell when you walk through the door. So they focus on different things, but they all kind of finish the same things at the same time. So for me, it's about manufacturing. So those countries and how they approach the building of the watch is very interesting to me.
Yeah. Blake Mallon, what do you think?
Yeah. So I would say sort of the inverse. Watches from different countries don't make me necessarily want to visit the visit the country, but visiting countries makes me want to, like, I always want to buy watches when I go places to sort of commemorate experiences, if that makes sense. Similar to with James, I mean, we both did at the time when we went to Damascus, we bought Damasco's at the Mono store. And that was a really awesome experience. And I think...
And we drank champagne while we did it.
Yeah, it's true. It was very chichi.
As one does.
Yeah. But I could definitely see, especially once all this COVID stuff is over and we're able to travel again, like I've mentioned before, the minute traveling is safe, like you guys aren't going to see me for a while. I'm going to be gone. But you know, I think I personally will probably approach travel a little bit differently in the future. Like, I think I'm going to really appreciate the ability to be sort of going, getting around in a different way, at least for a little while. It's going to feel much more novel and special. I don't know. Having this taken away from us for such a prolonged period of time has been really tough. So I could totally see visiting manufacturers and using that as an opportunity to pick something up for sure.
Yeah. So I don't know about you guys. I took this question as maybe like you get a Seiko and you want to go hang out in Japan, like not necessarily visit their manufacturers, but you know, does it make you want to go and take in
you visiting the manufacturers,
the culture that produced it, right? And like the average Joe is not just going to be, you know, knocking on Seiko's door like, hey, I bought this turtle, now can I get a you know, can I get the full treatment here? what about you, Zach?
It's an interesting question. I don't know whether to interpret it as like via worn and wound and being able to do these experiences, or when I have a watch, I'm just looking at when you buy a watch from a different country. I'm just thinking like when I wear a watch and am I thinking about, oh, like this is a watch from X country. Does it make me want to go there? I'm not sure, but I guess to sort of riff on what Blake Mallon was saying, like I also like the idea of maybe building in like traveling to a place to get the watch that maybe like is very special that you ordered and kind of have that experience. And I know like people do that on, you know, for like much higher end watches and watch collecting, where you kind of like, it's part of the experience kind of to go and get it from the person. And while not, you know, on the Philippe Dufour list or, you know, whatever, or the, you know, whoever, but like
Isle of Man. If you're on the Isle of Man, like you obviously have to buy a Roger W. Smith watch, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, that while that's not happening, you know, I there's showrooms and like there's just different ways to have the kind of experience that, you know, can get away from a little bit of that impersonal internet buying. And you know, I feel like that is like a reason to go someplace and to appreciate the culture. And I often find when you do meet the people or go to these places, the watches make more sense somehow, you know. I don't know. And I'm, you know, wearing a British watch right now. I have a few watches from British brands, and like we were in London the other year for just like 2 days, and it was such a great experience that like wearing those watches does make me want to go back to London, but it's because I'm kind of tying it back with like the experience of having gone there. And I would love to, and you know, because I'm so obsessed with watches, I could go there and I'd, you know, like to meet up with, you know, Nicholas from Fears watches, or go check out Garrick watches, or go, you know, to the Isle of Man and take a look at, you know, the workshop there and just all that stuff. But yeah. It's a real, that's like next level obsession though. When you look at your watch, you know, like imagining the, you know, the mountains,
the Jura Mountains.
Yeah, you know, But it's nice though. It's part of the romance of it. You know?
Yeah, I will say also that sort of the international nature of this watch community and hobby that we have has sort of shaded, I think, my thoughts about traveling too. Like I've found that as I talk with my girlfriend Jen about traveling like internationally, sometimes I am thinking like, oh well, if we go there, I know X, Y, and Z people who are there, and like we could get coffee with them, or they could show us around, you know. And that definitely shades my travel preferences, especially with international travel, because just by the nature of this hobby, I mean, even if you're just on Instagram, sort of making connections with people, I mean, you know, people all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it's a funk. I maybe just take it for granted because I've spent quite a bit of time in Switzerland and in Germany, whatever, covering this stuff. But when I'm wearing a watch, I don't really think about its country of origin. Like it's not something that crosses my mind, and it's certainly not something that I think about. Like when I glance at it, boy, I would like to visit wherever that watch is from. Like it just doesn't cross my mind. I like to travel. I like visiting other countries, and the watch I'm wearing has no bearing on that.
Would you say, like, do you think more about like maybe like what the watch is made for? Like, if it was a dive watch, you wish you're in the water, or driving a car, etc.
That definitely can have an inspiring effect. Yeah. And that I a good friend of ours, Jason Heaton, kind of tells the story about how he got into diving is because he bought a dive watch and didn't want to feel like a, you know, like a poser or anything. So he got into diving and then that's great. And you know, I feel a similar kind of pull with a lot of these watches. And I think that's what happens when you kind of buy into the lifestyle, you know, I'm sure by design of these brands. Yeah. You know, look what our watches can do and look at all the people that wear them. But, you know, how Rolex gets involved with these explorers that are doing really interesting things. You know, James Cameron going down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench. That was a follow-up because they were part of the mission, the original mission, doing that as well. But, you know, they had their watches, like, strapped to the outside. And, yeah, I think that's pretty cool stuff. And it's kind of inspiring to see, even if it's just, like, you know, yeah, I'm going to get out of the city and go for a hike in this area that I like over here or whatever it is, right? It doesn't have to be, like, I'm going to go make some Herculean effort or, you know, discover some lost, sunken treasure or something like that. But it's just kind of, it inspires you to, like, do... you know, to push yourself maybe a little bit out of your own bubble, right? Yeah. And this is a tool that, you know, it's not going to allow, you can do it with or without the watch, right? Like, let's be honest, you don't need any of these things to do any of that stuff, but it kind of gives you the extra bump to, like, yeah, I would enjoy doing that, and I could see myself doing that. And maybe having that watch on gives you, like, enriches that experience for you, like, just a little bit more, and kind of deepens your appreciation for that watch.
For sure.
Yeah, all right. All right. Thank you for the question, Tartan Watch Spaniel. Next up, we have at Acrylic Hand, who asks, who is responsible for the blue hype?
I blame you, Blake.
Me?
It's you. You did it.
Well, there you go. Answered.
So I don't know if it, like, is... I feel like blue watches have been a thing for a while. You know, I was telling you earlier, the Tudor Sub has had a blue
option
since like the 60s. Yeah. That's way better. Right. I don't know, like, at what point maybe it became like a ubiquitous, like, oh, every brand has some shade of blue in their collection on offer. And I think you it's kind of a turn of phrase that you hear now when you see a few green watches released. Mm-hmm. Oh, is green the new blue? Right, so it's kind of like this default understanding of, like, oh, blue is like this hot on trend or hype, as our questioner states it here. Do you guys view blue as a hype color, as a hot color?
Well, you know, I recall the first couple of years we went to Basel, that, like, it was like, what are the trends of Basel this year? And, like, you know, one of them was always, yeah, blue watches. Blue watches are making a comeback. So that's 2012, 2013-ish, so... I feel like maybe that was maybe when they started to resurface as a hype thing. And just as an anecdote, somebody in the industry recently told me that they're starting to see diminishing returns on blue dials. So, you know, maybe it's starting to wane now. But people have gotten a lot more adventurous with other colors, and you get blue dials might be sort of an entry and a gateway to colorful dials. So, like, you start with the blue, you end up with the reds and the yellows and the oranges and et cetera. So,
yeah. Is there what's going to replace blue? What's the next blue? Or is there no, like, oh, this is going to be a hot color for a while?
I mean, isn't
green?
Yeah,
green's the new blue. Yeah. That's what I'm hearing.
I'll definitely say that. You know, if you look back at the past couple of years, there's been a lot of green watches, and I mean, we're part of that. we introduced a lot of green watches ourselves, and we put, you know, green just seems to really be taking off the more we get into this year. And I would say that I've seen more green than blue over the last few years. I think blue's kind of like blue jeans, like, you just, everybody has that, but it's I think that there's a lot of product lines that didn't have green that added them. Even Autodromo this year made an entirely green watch, which
Safari,
was a great watch and sold out relatively quickly.
Yeah, I feel like there's some paper, some, I mean, blue's the color. I mean, isn't blue like the color every time you ask somebody what's your favorite color? Like 90% of dudes are like, blue's my favorite color. I'm so original. Like, I feel like it's all, like, blue is just such a common, yeah, it's blue jeans, it's blue. I mean, blue is just like
it's
a very
safe. It's a safe,
yeah,
bet, right?
I mean, it makes sense that it's kind of the default color, not black, white, but blue, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, I don't know. I think in terms of color trends, yeah, like green, like the fact that green became a thing is more interesting, or like I feel like you see a lot more like Fume or Gradient Dials. I feel like I've been seeing a lot of those. Bronze definitely had its moment. Like, you know, there's a lot of other sort of trends that are definitely coming and going, but I personally kind of feel like blue's just going to be around.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere. Yeah. Right. People aren't just going to be like, oh, blue sucks now, right? Like,
Yeah.
I feel like, and also with watches, like, you know, if the default for your watch is a black dial, then a blue dial is the next logical, not necessarily a full inverse white dial, because like that doesn't always work, mm-hmm. and it's kind of, I don't know, it just totally changes watches so much. So like, those like blue might be, yeah, blue is the other color. It's the alt, you know,
yeah,
the easy alt.
Yeah. So the answer is Levi's.
Yeah, you know, I would like to see more well done white dials. I think when a white dial is done well and it works, it's awesome. But I don't know. Maybe you just don't see them done all that well.
Yeah, too often. I agree. I mean, I agree. I mean,
smaller, dressier watches tend to have lighter dials, or it works a little better. Like I think of like Nomos watches; they have a like default white sort of on everything, and then they get funky as they go dark and more colorful. Whereas, yeah, if you drop just a white dial diver, it's kind of like, you know, that's the odd option. Also, because then you have Lume. Lume tends to be like light colored. You put light colored Lume on a light colored dial, it looks kind of funky. You need surrounds. You need, gets more complicated. But I don't know.
Yeah, but then like, you know, as I've talked about several times on the podcast, I got a Polar early this year. That is easily my favorite watch
with black surrounds. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of what makes it. It's like that.
Yeah. It's there's something about that watch. You know, it's like you look for this every time you get a new one, but it's like the day I got it, I was like giddy opening it up and putting it on. The first week I felt that way. And even now, every time I put it on, I'm like, oh, this is a treat. I'm so happy I'm putting this watch on. And it's a white dial watch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rolex, if you're listening, please bring the Explorer 2 back down to its 40 millimeter size. Yeah. We would all appreciate it. Okay, so I hope that answers your question. Acrylic hand, I think, maybe to be honest, we're not quite sure. So moving on to the next one is from at Watch With US channel.
Watch With Us channel, yeah.
That would make more sense. Yeah. We're still working on this. Yeah, Watch With... Well, they're all squished together, right? Like that.
Yeah,
it makes it's hard very, work, right?
It's very challenging.
I just happen to know them. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so this person asks, what do you think is the next big thing? A case material or a complication? As examples, I'm guessing. Jeez. What's the next big thing? That's not pressure or anything.
Yeah, getting
right?
out your betting money.
Yeah.
I think it's a good question, though. I feel like this year has been the year of the GMT. Maybe this year and last year. I don't know.
Yeah, a couple of years,
GMTs have done their thing.
I think we peaked.
Yeah, peak GMT. So, I mean, where else do you go from here? I don't know. I mean, there's obviously, I mean, Chronos have been around, and I don't know, Power Reserves, if that counts. And, you know, but I feel like GMT was, everybody was wanting for those GMTs, for affordable GMTs. I feel like that was a thing people were saying for a little while, at least in our circle, was, where, you know, we need more affordable GMTs, and they're here. They're here in spades at this point. So, yeah, I don't know.
I would say, I think it's not the next big thing because it's already very much here, but digital. So not necessarily digital LCD, but LED digital. So, you know, there's the Hamilton PSR, which they just brought back out, which is a fantastic watch, looks great, you know, kind of a retro style. Yama just came out with a red LED watch. Bulova, I think that was about a year and a half ago that they came out with. And I think that people are starting to take notice to the fact that that's something that they could do with a battery, that the battery capacities have just grown leaps and bounds over the last decade. So now that manufacturers are able to make not necessarily just an LCD, but an LED or an OLED screen, it's piquing people's interest. And with a lot of people wearing Apple watches, and then you kind of have the complete opposite direction of people wearing analog watches and saying, I'm not going to touch an Apple watch. It's kind of that in between. And a few people have thrown their hat into the ring, and I think it's picking up steam. I don't think it's quite there yet, but I think that a lot of people are interested, but interested to hear what you think.
I think that's a good point, James. And I agree with you. And my only question is, like does it have legs? And I think it taps into like a real like nostalgia for a lot of us that grew up in like the late 80s, early 90s, and these watches are priced in a manner that maybe is within the realm of like impulse purchase for a lot of people who are like, oh, I love the way that looks, or I had a watch similar to that when I was 8. So, you know, and it's $150 or $100. So, you know, they can justify it easily. Like, how popular would these be if they were like $1,500? Like, I probably, you know, I bought a Bulova Computron, you know, when those came out, and it was that hit of like, oh, this feels good. It was like getting like all my baseball cards out and like looking through them. And I know the baseball cards are similarly having a moment themselves. And, you know, my thinking is that, you know, if we fast forward 5 mm-hmm. years, even, how are we going to feel about this stuff? And are we going to just like have these, a lot of us will have like one or two of these in the back of our watch boxes. And
yeah.
Oh, I remember those, like those all came back, but you know, it's not really a practical thing that I'm just going to start wearing every day, right? Like, I have to press a button to see the time on that, and it was the same with the Emma. Like, they look really mm-hmm. cool, and they're fun to wear around, but, you know, it's not going to, like, oh, this is just the watch that I wear every day, right?
Right. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think digital is a really good point, you know, and I think what's also interesting, you have, like, double anniversaries, because, like, with the PSR, the Hamilton, that's the 50th anniversary, so, like, that's genuine vintage territory. And then you have like the 30th kind of anniversary for like our experience of them, or I guess the 20s. Like I think in the 90s, I only wore digital watches. Like I had tons of Ironmans and things like that. Not tons, I don't know, I had several. They were really cool. And like, I think about some of the tech, like I had one that was Anadigi, but the LCD just floated over the dial. So you could like turn it on. Like I haven't seen anyone do that again. That's cool. Mm-hmm. And it would, if somebody did it now, they'd be like, oh my God, like I've never seen it. But then also, you know, something like the Safarni, which you got, which is really nice. So that's Anadigi yeah. once again. Yeah. But several years ago, there was actually another digital revival, and granted it's more than several years ago, like maybe go 15 years ago or so. And I was not as involved obviously in the watch industry. So I don't know how like the watch world interacted with this, but there was this brand Nuka, which actually Bradley Price and I talked about on a previous podcast, which like made these alternative sort of style of digital watches that didn't have the like, normal readouts. Like it wasn't just a screen, it was like blocks that would fill in, and they were really cool. It was made out of solid metal. I had to have it, and like that was, my parents got me one for my 21st birthday, and it was amazing. And then there was, that company got fairly big, very much like streetwear stuff that's happening now. That guy did 15 years ago, and I think it was just way too ahead of its time, but now it would fit right in. But there was Tokyo Flash and all these like companies that made these really, really funky digital watches that you could get at like funky tech stores. Like there was a place called like AC Gear, I think, on 8th Street. That was awesome. It would be cool to see that happen, but now in like the micro brand world and the more independent world, to see how these people are more involved in watches and watchmaking and have like the prowess of watchmaking brands come in rather than kind of like cheapy tech stuff. Mm-hmm. Nuka wasn't cheapy tech. That was like watches, but a lot of it was sort of cheapy tech. But the other thing I was just going to say, and I think, you know, you mentioned with Fume dials, I think the next trend is going to be dial finishing and texturing. You know, I think, you know, just noticed this week, like Notice came out with another version of their Sector diver watch, and there's this beautiful silvery aqua kind of dial they did. I've never seen a dial like it. It's sort of multiple levels of fume, but it's not just like black to black or blue to black or something really simple. It's much more nuanced, and it just totally changes the watch. And you know, that watch with a flat color would be very nice as well, but this makes it totally different than anything I've seen before. And you know, I feel like brands are realizing that's just another way they can have more distinction. And I think it's something that couldn't have happened a little while ago because the factories wouldn't have been able to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, like even the watch we made with Christopher Ward, like that dial is very complicated. Like I'm excited for people to see it in person because there's a lot of layers, a lot of cutouts and all sorts of things. I don't think Christopher Ward could have made that 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like it took their manufacturers to get there. It took or they could have, and it would have been just outrageously expensive for something to finish this well. So that to me is like, it's a subtle trend, but I think you're just going to see like just a lot more finishing and nuance coming out of it.
That would be great. I mean, that would be really exciting because it would just be a way also to refresh things without having to. It seems like that's a canvas with a lot of opportunities on it. Whereas mm-hmm. I think, you know, with like the just, you know, with movement trends or things like that, it's like there's a finite amount of them, and you know, you kind of, it terminates, like you've done everything.
And you can ask for, yeah, like I want ultra thin chronographs that are $600, yeah, but yeah, like good luck. You yeah, know?
Yeah. But I would say going back to the digital piece too, just that, I think that, you guys were mentioning it. I think it's also a lot about the 90s, like a lot of things about the, I mean, this isn't like news, but like baseball cards, collectibles like that, they're all coming back. You know what I mean? And I feel like, it's just the right generation, people with a little bit of disposable income who are sort of like feeling a nostalgia to those things. Mm-hmm. And I think what's really exciting is I can't wait for brands to start, you know, like micro brands and smaller independent brands to start throwing their hat in the ring and doing that in a serious way. Like I want to see brand, I want to see, you know, I don't know, I want to see Notice do a really really serious take in an Anadigi watch.
Yep. That would be great.
I think that would be amazing.
Yeah. One quick comment, just on what you had just said about ultra thin chronographs coming in at $600. I feel like production, like sophistication, will hopefully be getting to a point that might allow something like that. You know, when you think back to like the 80s, and it was only like high end sports cars that had like direct injection type things, right? And now it's like just, you know, a Honda Civic has that, like everything has that kind of stuff. Like, is it going to be a similar kind of trend where, you know, eventually just Sellita will have an option in their catalog that, you know, of an ultra thin, you know, chronograph movement that's like fully integrated and it's not like modularized. Yeah. So I
that'd
hope
be
so.
Awesome. It's I guess part of the tricky thing there is that like there's only a handful of manufacturers that really produce on scale. And especially in Switzerland, and, you know, I mean, if a Chinese brand like Seagull, or I think there's Hangzhou is another one, like made something, would it get the kind of buy-in it would need to really?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. But like, yeah. And then like what, I guess it's up to Seagull and ETA to determine whether or not like there's, you know, if they need to do it, right? Yeah, like they're making enough, they're selling out of everything anyway. Do they need to invest in all this new stuff, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But I mean, that Horage is very cool, the K2. People should look that up. So they're in kind of, it's not out yet, but they've made a kind of an ultra-thin micro-rotor movement that they're trying to get into the hands of brands by 2023, I believe. And it's very much like a forward-facing movement. It's not a chronograph, but I believe it's designed to allow for modules. And it's starting off so thin that, you know, you might end up with at least thinner than a Valjoux kind of chronograph.
Yeah, I think I would just adding to that really quickly, I think the idea of an ultra-thin chronograph is cool, but even just a thinner chronograph would be great. Yeah. Because I think, you know, I've kind of gotten to the point where I've had some recently where, you know, like I think the 103 is a good example. Like it's not thin, it's pretty thick, but they've done a few little tricks to make it wear nicely. Mm-hmm. You know, Christopher Ward has some really nice chronographs that wear nice and thin. I think Young Hands makes a few that are wear really thin. And, you know, a watch, for example, that I picked up a few years ago, the Stoa Flieger, like classic Flieger. It's the single register, sub register chronograph they make. Amazing watch. I love that watch. So cool. It just was too thick for me. I just didn't wear it because of the thickness. If it were just like 2 millimeters thinner, it would be perfect.
Yeah.
A millimeter and a half.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to hit one more question, and then we'll have to. There's a lot of great questions. We'll have to kind of push the others aside to the next episode, next time we do one of these, which I think we should, because it's a lot of fun. We love hearing from our listeners out there. So the last one that we're going to get to is at Integrated Bracelet. What is the line between micro brand and independent? Where do brands like Ming sit? There's a lot there in that question. I feel like we could have an entire podcast episode about that one question. You know, I'll just start off by saying I don't. I know that a lot of small brands don't really like the term micro brand, and they don't like applying it to themselves, especially. When I heard that from some of the small brands, I just kind of removed that from my lexicon of thinking, and I just kind of started referring to them all as like small independent brands. So to me, that's just kind of what it is. Like, that's just what they are. They are small independent brands.
Yeah. I mean, they certainly are, by definition, small independent brands. And I do think there was, at least for a while, micro brand sort of had a negative connotation to it, or sort of used to be like dismissive of, oh, these inexpensive watches that are coming out by small independent brands, that they're just the micro brands. But now, you know, I think it's more of a, because it's grown so much and there's so many brands and doing such amazing things. And, you know, anybody now who's a snob about it just is a snob for being a snob's sake. Like, they're not looking at the watches anymore. That, like, now it's almost like a, it's a symbol of like a disruptive element in the industry. And I hate the whole term disruptive and everything, but it's just like, it really, you know, they came in, they had a new format of how to sell watches and how to design watches and how to manufacture watches that was, you know, not the way the Swiss traditional watch industry did it. And they grew in popularity, they grew in their capacity. And now there are brands that are totally working within the Swiss, you know, industry in a typical sense, like, you know, whether it's just Swiss made, like a Manta or something like that, which is a small independent brand, probably not a brand that thinks of themselves as a micro brand, but, you know, they are making beautifully made Swiss watches with Swiss movements that say Swiss made on the dial. But then you have somebody like Zelos, who made a Swiss Tourbillon this year, mixing a, I believe it was a Le Jus Perret movement, like Tourbillon movement, that is a high-end movement with crazy cases and doing all sorts of manufacturing based from a lot of their what they do in Asia, and mixing these two things together, making a $10,000 Tourbillon that sold out in minutes. You know, like, that's disruptive, I think. You know, I'm sure there are plenty of brands out there, Swiss brands, independent brands, that would have their nose up in the air thinking, oh, how did they get these movements? You know, how many Tourbillons does Le Jus Perret make in a year? It's probably not very many. So the fact that they got that, I don't know. And that's amazing to me. So now I think, like, micro, like, hell yeah. Like, celebrate it. Like, you're not the traditional industry. You're the side. You're this other thing that's grown.
Interesting. So you think they should embrace it?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, for sure.
James Helms, what about you? What do you think?
It's really about the capabilities of the brand itself. And you can start a brand with, you know, just a style and what the ethos of a brand is. And there's a lot of fantastic brands. I won't even name any names. And some of those brands are one person. Some of them are five. Some of them are 10. And they may not make any watches in their facility at all. You know, somebody may do it entirely for them. And that's great that they do a killer job 9 times out of 10 with that. To me, an independent is when you increase your capabilities, and you can be a micro brand, and I'm using air quotes, to get started, raise capital and figure out what direction you want to go to become a more independent watch brand that doesn't pull parts and pieces and use other, manufacturing partners to make what you have. It really all comes down to me to how much do you want to start with? How much capital are you starting with? Are you starting from a base? Are you in which direction are you going? And I think everybody at some point is a micro brand. You know, if we look back 200 years and how they started and how many watches they were making and when they became independent, you know, that takes people a year sometimes. That takes people 100 years sometimes. But I don't really think that there's a good or a bad or a different in between them. It's really about the story behind what they're making and how much effort that they're putting into it. So, you know, to me, it doesn't really matter. It's your execution of the product and how good it is. Mm-hmm. You can start a brand tomorrow and make an absolutely fantastic product that you don't even make.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of what we like to pay attention to. Here's what you put in front of us at the end of the day, you know, whatever you want to call yourself. What do you think, Blake?
Yeah, I think you guys all made really good points. Because I think, you know, James, to your point, this whole concept of independent incorporating some sort of elements of in-house manufacturing or something like that. I don't know if not that I disagree with you, but I feel like there is another term, maybe like there's another category.
Well, there's like an independent watchmaker.
Yeah.
Right. But there's still a line between like Philippe Dufour and
totally
Omega and Ming and Christopher Ward. Right. And like, there's more gradients, I think. Yeah. And it's not like it's cut and dry when you hear like a verticalized manufacturer and in-house movement.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes probably doesn't mean what people think it means. Like, totally. There's just one guy inside of this brand that's like designing and producing this movement all under one roof.
Right.
Very, very few brands actually do that, right? And so it gets a little fuzzy in there.
And I think there's also even more variance in there because you've got people doing different types of hand assembly. Then you've got guys like, you know, John over at Bespoke Watch Projects, where he's, you know, hand making dials and hands and mm-hmm. things like, there's just like, there's all kinds of crazy levels to it. So I think you bring up a good point of like, there needs to be some other level of categorization or characterization. But I think that, I think unfortunately in sort of today's, you know, vernacular, I think microban has led to a derogatory nature to it. Unfortunately, I think generally speaking, I think, like it sort of suggests like a lack of permanence or seriousness or, you know, big B brandness to it. There's just, it sort of takes something away from someone, which I think is unfortunate. And for that reason, I think I even said microbrand earlier when I was talking about brands, but I know that when I'm kind of writing things out, when I'm writing copy or whatever the case may be, I generally go with small independent brand because I just don't want people to take it the wrong way. But at the same time, I totally agree with what Zach said. I mean, I think the, you know, using like the micro brew, you know, comparison, it's like, that's what it's all about. Like, that's like, you're going to find the crazy double IPAs and the this and the that and the, all the kind of crazy, you know, beers at a micro brewery. You're not going to find it at the big brewery. Like, that's kind of a major distinction. So, yeah, I mean, I think I wouldn't. It's funny. It's the kind of thing where it's like, I would kind of wait for a brand to call itself a micro brand before I would probably use that term moving forward.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
And as far as Ming goes, yeah, small independent, or whatever you want to call him, he does.
I mean,
interesting.
What's so interesting about Ming is that, I mean, he came out of the gate with this sort of like putting this conflict into the spotlight by making two very different watches with similar aesthetics. I mean, and they're very different in terms of price point and execution. One's, I think the first ones that were launched, you know, there's one under 1,000 and then there was one probably around 10K working with Schwarz Etienne and having this amazing in-house movement. And then the other one was, you know, I mean, what you expect to find in under $1,000 movement. I can't remember. I forget if he used Swiss or an Asian movement to launch, but, you know, and they were both very successful. And so right at the gate, was like, who can do that? Can you do that? Can you make affordable watches and expensive watches? And, you know, Ming in his way is just kind of like, I do whatever the hell I want, mm-hmm. you know, deal with it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think that's very much like right in the face of sort of traditional marketing concepts and branding concepts that a larger brand just couldn't do, right? Rolex couldn't drop a $500 watch tomorrow. Everyone would be so confused, you know?
Or you look at what Autodromo did with the 4GT.
Yeah, yeah, great example.
I mean, if he, you know, barring that project, I think a lot of people would maybe call his brand a micro brand, but he had an exclusive partnership with the largest, you know, one of the largest car brands in the world around their most exclusive and important car in the last 20 years, right? I mean, it's kind of fair to say. So, Blake's shaking his head.
It's
cars.
You could make that argument. I would say
the Ford Fit was
the Ford Fit, obviously. Yes. Yeah. Now, the original launch of the GT in when they first brought it back, was that 2004 or something like that?
Oh, was it that recently? I thought it was a little bit longer ago.
That was I think the new Ford GT was a surprise. Mm-hmm. It was like
the
a
new
surprise
Ford,
drop.
The new GT1, right? Whereas the mid. The one in the early 2000s, did that win races the way the new one did?
No, that was the other big thing, right? Yeah. The new Ford GT, they stuck in Le Mans the year they released it, and it won the GTL, the GTE Pro class. Okay. Yeah, Le Mans that year, if I'm not mistaken. If I am, let me know in the comments, but we'll save the car talk for the next episode.
Bradley is actually going to be here in like 20 minutes to show some prototypes.
We'll talk to him about it. Yeah.
we'll ask him.
All right. So a huge thank you to everyone who sent in questions and accept our apologies if we didn't get to it. Please keep sending them in. We will do this again. We love hearing from you and we love answering these questions. Until next time, take care.
Goodbye.
Thanks.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn and Wound podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then please leave us a review on iTunes, and also be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch, a strap? Then visit windupwatchshop.com, and of course, head over to wornandwound.com daily for great watch content. Music tracks Nowhereland and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.